Welcome to Olympic and Bundy, our podcast out of West LA. I'm Christine Devine. I truly believe this episode has an international message of hope and encouragement. I am so thrilled to recommend and welcome my guest from LA with a message to, I think it's sure to resonate with a lot of people. We're talking about suicide, a very real issue in today's society. I personally think we all know somebody touched by this. She is dynamic, she is vibrant, she's outspoken. You all know Melissa Rivers. I am so thrilled that you have time for me today.
Well, thank you. And I'm a, you know, Los Angelino
since
I was 3 years old. So it was Christine Devine.
Well, for those who are joining us from outside of L.A., I'm a news anchor here at Fox L.A., Fox 11. And, you know, I love getting out in the community. I've always done that. But now with this podcast, we're bringing you all to Olympic and Bundy. And we're able to talk really in depth because I covered the Suicide Prevention Center unveiling.
Yes, Dee Hirsch Mental Health Services and Suicide Prevention Center. And you and I actually got into quite a long conversation the day of the sign unveiling.
Right.
Which was such a big deal because we are the first in California, and I'm pretty sure first in the country, that we actually have signage in the front of our building that says Suicide Prevention Center.
And that's so important. You know, you being a TV host, you have your own website. We know you through the world of entertainment. But this is such a personal topic, and you were front and center there at this new center. How comfortable now are you talking about suicide? We all know the story of your father who died by suicide many years ago.
I was 18.
Where's your comfort zone with this now?
I talk about it always, and I have no sort of shame, I mean, which is such the wrong word. I have no trouble talking about it. I think one of the ways that my mother and I both recovered from my father's suicide was because we talked about it. And I think my talking about it came from about 3.5 weeks after my father killed himself. I went back to school. I was in college. And I went to University of Pennsylvania, which is in Philadelphia. And my dad had killed himself in Philadelphia. And everyone was so scared to talk to me. No one knew what to say. No, and I was so angry. And it was such an in-your-face kind of primal scream of basically, F you. You're scared to talk to me. I dare you not to. And if you do dance around it, I'm going to be right in your face about this is what happened. And I even the words I would choose, the language I would use at the very beginning was very aggressive language.
Well, you started to use the word shame. You see, I don't feel any shame. It's funny because I still feel I have trouble getting the words out of my mouth.
Right.
And I've worked with the Dee Hirsch Mental Health Services for many years, a good 20 years.
Yeah.
I've emceed their walk that they do.
Yep.
I've gone to their walk many times. I've had a number of friends who've dealt with this, whether it's a daughter, a father, a mother, or a friend. So it's not a foreign topic to me. I still feel like I struggle saying the word. But now with the center, we're staying at front and center.
Right. And also, I don't think I was so aggressive about it in the beginning. But, you know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't attack people. But I would have friends that would be like, oh, my God, I want to kill myself. And then the room would go silent. I'm like, no, it's fine. You can say that. Like, I'm not thinking that you're rolling your eyes and saying you want to kill yourself because you have so much work has anything to do with me or my dad or my circumstances. And I think because there were so many fallacies about it that I've been saying lately, you know, it's like something that was so born out of anger and almost in a retaliatory way to everybody who wanted to pretend that it didn't happen has become something that's, you know, part of my life's work, my purpose.
Well, I think for people who haven't encountered this and haven't discussed it and haven't learned some of the tools, maybe you don't know what to say.
And that's a lot of the problem. And that's also a lot of the problem, or has been in the past, discussing mental health. Now, 5 years ago, you couldn't say mental health. Now, it's front and center. Everybody talks about mental health. Nobody's embarrassed by it. Someone has this. Someone has that. They're seeing a therapist. They're getting help. Everyone now is addressing it, and everyone's got depression, and everybody, you know, just watch TV and see how many commercials there are for products that, you know, that help depression. And everyone's doing meditations. And it's wonderful that it's become such a part of the national conversation. Now we need to do the same with suicide, which mm-hmm. is so much still a silent killer.
And when you said, like, if somebody says, I want to kill myself, because I've worked in this arena a bit, I kind of do a double take and think, now let's talk for a minute. Where are we at with this? Because for some people, they're saying it in a real way.
I'm talking about more like when I went back to school, and my friends would be like, "Oh my god,
right?
I'm so tired of it. Someone's worried I'm going to kill myself." Like, that's fine. We know the difference.
Exactly. But also the reality of when somebody is saying it seriously, it's not something to be ignored.
No,
and we're talking about that now.
And you can't say, "Oh, it's going to be fine."
Okay, what do you say?
You engage in the conversation. You try and talk about, well, what is so different? Why are you so unhappy? What's going on? You have to reach out. You have to talk to people. And you cannot be afraid that you are having these feelings. And also, which is so important, and I think especially with teens. And the ironic thing is my father and I had this conversation 2 months before he killed himself when a friend from high school had killed themselves for me, which was suicide is a permanent answer to a temporary problem. Now, granted, he didn't heed his own advice, which is a whole other thing. But especially for teens, everything seems so end of the world, crucial, you know, just nothing's ever going to be the same and I'm never going to get through this. No, you are. But it is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And the sooner you can get people talking and not being ashamed that they have these feelings and that they have these faults and that there is someone to listen,
I really
it's
want
to so important.
Tackle three different categories, and you kind of hit on all of them in that last statement. One, I want to talk about your advocacy, and I want to talk about the Suicide Prevention Center, mm-hmm. and also the personal story, because I think everyone has their own personal story. So why don't we start there? You were 18 years old mm-hmm. in college. Mm-hmm. Did you know that your father was hurting, suffering, in pain?
Well, I knew he was depressed. You know, my parents were in a very rough situation. My mother had just lost her Fox show, and my dad took the blame for it because somebody needed to be blamed.
And he was the producer of it.
Right. And my father, who life was about protecting my mother, took all the heat. And it was a very rough time and very depressed and all these different sort of things. Plus, this is back in the day, it had a quadruple bypass. And this is back in the day when they would still crack people's chests. And people would be on heart-lung machines for hours and hours and hours, which they have later discovered. These say heart patients, you know, have major depression because it scared them. It also turns out that being on the heart-lung machine that long could affect the adrenal gland. And that, again, has all sort of repercussions. And that is one of the reasons that very often heart patients back in the day suffered from depression.
Okay, so your father and obviously your mother, Joan Rivers, yes. had this fantastic show on our network, Fox, which yes. is really cool for us as well. They worked closely together.
Yes.
So then he has this medical situation
right.
that you say contributed to the depression.
Yes, and okay. never got the medication right and never, you know, he never was in good health really after that. It was one complication after the next. And there was no one really seeing what medication is doing what and this and that. And the therapist was putting on something else. And then he actually just, not only because of these reasons, he was depressed.
Yeah.
And obviously.
And many of us would be.
Yeah. And did not see a way out. And I think part of it is he did not see a way out without hurting my mother's career or my mother. I think he honestly felt like he was such a hindrance.
So
now, again, 2020, looking back.
Yeah. And so your father overdosed on prescription pills.
Yes.
Had you seen any signs of a possible suicide attempt in the past?
No.
So this came with quite a shock.
Quite a shock.
Yeah.
Quite a shock. Like, never in my wildest dreams would I think this is how it would have ended up, especially after saying to me, 2 months before, suicide is a permanent answer to a temporary problem.
So you thought he'd be the last person that would yes. go that route because he's already talking about it.
And he wasn't dramatic.
Advice. Yeah.
This isn't a man who was like dramatic and, flinging himself across furniture. This was someone who was very stoic and strong.
As I'm hearing you tell your story, I just have these visions of when my father died in a scuba diving accident, which is very bizarre, right?
Very, and very, like, un- not something you could ever possibly imagine.
Exactly. So I remember getting the call, and my mom said, "Ooh, I would get teary-eyed. Your father didn't make it." And I'm like, "What do you mean didn't make it?" And literally my knees buckled, mm-hmm. and I just dropped to the floor. I'm wondering, where were you when you got the news, and how did you react?
I was at home. My mother was not at home. My mother, this is again back in the day, had decided to have some liposuction. And that was when they had to put you in, when you did it overnight in the hospital, and she was at Cedars. And sorry, I got the call, mm-hmm. or I got informed by Gavin DeBecker, who was a very close friend of our family and did all of our security for years. And I was like, why is Gavin at the house? And he had been informed, and he came to tell me. And then we got me over to Cedars as my mother was literally checking out. And I had to tell my mom. Wow. And I'm not like, you went to your knees. I go cold. Mm-hmm. I go cold. I remember just going absolutely cold. And the only other time I've had that actual physical, I mean, I've had minor versions of it, was when I got the phone call about my mom. It was the only other time I ever had that same very intense, like, shivering.
Yeah. They're very difficult chapters in life.
Well, because they're so sudden.
Yeah.
Like, I go to bed and everything's fine. I wake up and everything's a disaster.
I remember when I flew home, because this was in Arizona, my mother still had the dinner plates on the table, you know, expecting my father to come home because it was at a lake. And it was just so surreal to see the fork and the plates and, you know, and life just suddenly changed. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm dealing with the issue of suicide with a friend right now. Mm-hmm. And they're in the freshness of all the pain.
Did they lose someone or did they attempt?
They lost someone, a daughter. I'm wondering what you would say to this person about, I'm sure the pain never goes away. It stays with you forever.
I mean, I think anyone who loses a child, I don't know how you get over the pain mm-hmm. at all. And this is not unsad. Sadly, there are a lot of teen suicides or someone just lost a child to suicide. What do you say? I mean, honestly, you lead with, there is nothing I can possibly say that is going to make you feel any better. But I am here. I will help you. You tell me you want me there, I'm there. You tell me to go away, I'll go away. Mm-hmm. Acknowledge that their pain is something that must be unbearable. Don't go into, it's going to be okay. Because mm-hmm. in the midst of it, you're like, I can't even begin to think about the next minute, let alone if I'm going to be okay. And just say, you've got to get them to start talking. Because I have found, being a suicide survivor, there's so much anger.
And a lot of questioning. And a lot, if we could only turn back time.
And I always say people have to really, the most important thing is to deal with what I call the what ifs and the if onlys.
Mm-hmm. You went through that too?
Oh my God, who doesn't go through them? Of course. Of course, what if I had done this? If only I had done that. And as a friend, that's what you need to be aware of, because if you don't start addressing those and talking about them right away, the what ifs and the if onlys can eat someone alive.
Mm-hmm. Did you get therapy right away on this?
My mother made me go directly into grief counseling.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever part of a support group?
No, I was in Philadelphia back at school, very angry. Very unhappy. So the best my mom could convince me to do was grief counseling. I didn't even want to do that, but I did. Thank God, by the way.
You know, and you also being with a famous family, you know, the whole world knows what happened to you and your family.
Right.
You know, most of us can kind of grieve within the confines of our colleagues and our friends and those who know us.
Well, but you have people camping outside your house.
What do you mean?
Like to take pictures.
Oh,
because at the time, remember, we weren't a 24-hour news cycle.
Right.
And I remember it was a huge deal. We were on the cover of People magazine walking out of the service. Mm.
Yeah.
Go back to school 3 weeks later. It's kind of like, can't really hide.
Did that perhaps help propel you to be a voice for this? Look, I've lived my whole life in front of the camera.
Well, at the time, you don't think about that. We didn't live our lives in front of the cameras then.
Relatively speaking.
No, I mean, remember there were four networks.
Right, and no social media.
And no social media, right. And no TMZ. and interviews were much more controlled. So I think what was so rattling was the level of interest was something that I wasn't personally prepared for that fell onto me.
It had to feel so intrusive to be...
I felt like a freak.
Yeah, sure, sure.
I felt like I'm being... Like, why are you staring at me? Or as I used to say, as I have said to people in the past, like whenever you're dealing with someone and... I always say it's like when you're dealing with a workman or something like that, and they're trying to sort of talk down. You go, "Did I forget to wipe the word idiot off my forehead again this morning? Can you just do I? Did I get it off?
Right.
You know." And you felt, you know, you feel like, why is everybody knows? I guess it is intrusive, way too much, and don't look at me with that sort of poor you face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's by the way, with your friends who are dealing. That's one of the things you don't, as a friend, you don't want to do that to them. You've got to be like, I'm here. When you want me, I'll leave. When you don't want me, you know, if you want me, I'll sleep on the end of your bed.
Well, we had a neat moment where I took him out. I was running an errand on some location. I said, just tag along.
Yeah.
And he got him out of the house. It was great.
But exactly. It's those you have to help them with those little victories, whether it's even when they don't want to leave the house, grabbing food and bringing it over and make them sit at the dining room table or the kitchen table and eat.
Well, that moment was neat because we bumped into somebody, and that person had no idea what had happened. And this gentleman could have a normal conversation about the sun and the trees and the nearby restaurant, and I saw a sense of normalcy for just a minute. When in your process did you start feeling some kind of sense of normalcy with your new norm?
Well, I think that goes back to grief in general. You know, as they say, the seven stages of grief. There's just... sort of a different lens to look at it through when you're dealing with suicide, where I always say to people, everyone has the same emotions when someone dies, but you add in anger and a lot more questions. So it's kind of like, I always say, it's sort of like grief plus, because you have to deal with so many questions that you don't have when someone has a sort of a traditional normal passing. But it really is all lumped in the same. It's just a heightened version.
So
it takes you the normal amount of time, just like it would take anybody. But I feel like sometimes and this is not saying that normal grief isn't significant. There's a different kind of anger that has to be processed simultaneously. And again, like I always go back to, do not let the what if and the if onlys eat you alive.
Well, I love that the D.D. Hirsch Mental Health Services has been there for so long, 70 years. They are just a great voice, a nonprofit here in Los Angeles. I've known them for their hotline that people can call 24/7.
And how about since we put up the signage that says suicide prevention?
Fantastic.
People have walked in.
Talk to me about that.
We're just hearing about a bunch of a woman who was an Uber driver was going to kill herself, and she kept looking for a sign. And what I was told was she was going to park her car and walk into traffic. Mm. And she came right down Olympic, right just past Century City, saw the sign, pulled over, and walked in.
Yeah, I knew that story. I just didn't know if I was allowed to tell it.
Yes, I mean, it's an incredible story.
It really is. And the thing is, I drive by that location every night after our newscast at 11 p.m. midnight, and I saw the building going up. I saw the sign coming up. And when I drive by at midnight, I see that, I think it's third floor, the lights are
on. And that's
on.
That's the crisis hotline center. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's not necessarily set up for people to walk in. You know, there's not someone standing at the front saying, and you are, you know. But the fact that that someone will walk in means the message is getting out there. That there is help.
Well, that
and
day,
when there's help, there's hope.
That day of that opening, I can see it visually in my mind. You, Ronda Rousey, Keita Curry, who's the head of D.D. Hirsch, standing by that sign as they dropped the drape on it. And it was just big and bold. And you can't miss it if you're driving by Olympic.
No, and it's so important. Again, it's getting it out there. The more we talk, the more comfortable everybody gets with sort of the vernacular and not frightened to say, hey, I think you need to call someone, or hey, I have a friend who maybe isn't doing so well, and learning more, especially, and like for me, it's so crucial with the next generation, because the stats on suicide, the people who attempt and or succeed are getting younger and younger.
Well, they have a teen center there as
yes,
well, right?
But it's getting younger and younger.
I heard, what, as young as 5 years old, they've gotten a call on their hotline?
Yeah.
That is disturbing.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
And hopefully if we can talk about it, at least we can start to fix, not necessarily fix the problem, but at least begin to fix the problem.
So when this happened with your father, you're dealing with your grief. When does it come to a point where you're able to get on a microphone now and talk about it with some advocacy?
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Very quickly. My mother and I were able to do that. We were originally part of a group called Suicide Survivors, which people get very confused because when you hear suicide, there's a group called Suicide Survivors. There are people that have survived
an attempt. Right.
And then there's Suicide Survivors who are people who have survived losing a loved one to suicide. And it became such a healing community. I remember the very first dinner we went to, I think it was my senior year in college. My father killed himself right before my junior year. And it was either my senior year in college or my first year out of college. We went to the big dinner. And I want to say they honored us or something because we'd already been talking about it. And during cocktails, I remember walking around and people would start talking and just crying because here was someone who literally understood what they were going through. So for me, it really became part of who I am. I think it really became much more purposeful, really, as I was raising a child and as I was learning more about warning signs and this. And I think that's really when something else clicked in me. And like I have said, and I said it to you, was something that I used to speak of out of anger has become such a driving force for the positive in my life.
Well, my first introduction to the event, their Alive and Running Walk in September, is they'd asked me to MC it. So as a news anchor, sure, I'll MC.
Yeah, why not? I can do this in my sleep.
Coincidentally, one of my colleagues had a family friends, and they'd fixed me up with their son. And he was gorgeous, and he played baseball, and he had a great family, the kind of family that went to the river every summer with their, you know, boats, and just an intact family, kind of the dream scenario.
Right.
This guy's got it all.
Yeah.
And when he ended his life by suicide, a shock. I still can't believe it.
Right.
The family all came out, and we did the walk, and we wore buttons for Matt.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my introduction to not feeling alone in this.
Right.
As I go to this walk every year, I see families with their strollers, mothers, fathers, cousins, and there's this great embroidered kind of artwork of faces of people, the famous faces,
mm-hmm.
The brothers, the sons, the uncles, and it's just reminds you that you're not alone, and like you said, to have somebody who understands what you've been through.
I also do work with Our House, which is a credible grief center. And for me, they very much fold into one another in the sense of you have to continue to talk. And I know people who have gone to Our House and it's been tremendously helpful.
I'm not aware of them.
Oh, they're fantastic.
I might have to refer them.
Yeah.
Yes?
You check them out, Our House.
Okay.
Was it ourhouse.com?
Ourhousegrief.com.
They're amazing. I'm trying to get the two organizations to communicate more. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm brokering a marriage. But, you know, everybody's so focused. And now also with DeHurst doing bereavement. But this is ongoing. Our House is ongoing grief support.
Well, as you know from my story, I'm going to need this recommendation to pass this on.
Yes.
Because,
and what they do there is tremendous. But they also do a huge walk.
Okay.
And they provide services above and beyond the sort of acute bereavement and the acute grief, especially with teens and kids.
You keep bringing up the teens and kids. What's your great concern there?
I have one.
Okay.
I have one. Mm-hmm. My son is now 18, and he is smack dab in the dead center of the statistically highest group of suicides. And we talk openly about it, and I know he would – well, I don't want to say I know because that's like asking for a problem, but I would be highly surprised if he ever did that. But we do talk about it. We do talk about how I lost my father. And sadly, we also talk about how I lost my mother. because to have one person die suddenly, like you had with your dad, to have lightning strike twice is unusual. And I was a single parent. My son's father is still in his life, but my mother was really his other parent. So at 12, 13 years old, suddenly he basically lost a parent when he lost my mom in a shocking, sudden, and violent way. And so I become so aware of what kids go through and don't talk about, and being able to sort of live that firsthand, how different it is now to be a teenager than when we were all teenagers.
And then imagine, too, the social media aspect.
Well, referring to. And I've always been very moved and sort of upset about all these stories we would hear. And then when I actually had a teenager who was grieving in my home, who I loved more than anybody in the world, and I could not take his pain away.
Yeah, you can't.
You start to look at all these things differently because they become fears.
I love,
and that's why I'm always talking about children. That was such an eye-opener for me.
I love, though, that you are using what you've been through to actually be a voice for others. And I think that that's part of the healing for people. You know, wherever you're at, you can do something with that.
Absolutely. And from day one, you must be talking. Mm-hmm. Even though you can look at someone and just be like, when I talk to people, and I don't know if I can say it to you guys because you don't always believe me. The first conversation I have with anybody who's lost someone, but specifically when I talk to people who are suicide survivors, is, let me just explain to you, this sucks.
Right.
And well, it's not normal, and it's not right, and guess what? It's not okay. And I'm not going to candy coat, and I'm not going to say all the stupid things people said to me, or especially if someone's there in a better place. No, good for them. I'm not. Guess what? I'm not in a better place. And I think being that honest is very disarming, but it certainly cuts through the noise. And the first time you say something, you know what? This is effed up, and I am here for you because guess what? This is going to be work. You watch people let down their guard.
It's fantastic, though, that not only are we talking about it, that there are these support groups, there are places to go, Dee Dee Hirsch, the other location that you mentioned. I don't remember that, you know, back in the day.
We didn't have it. We didn't talk about it. People didn't go to therapy. And if they did, it was like, you know, what they all go to in the 80s was like Est and, you know, sweat lodges. I don't even know. But I remember all my parents' friends were always off doing something self-helpy.
Well, my introduction to therapy is I had a best friend getting his PhD and said, will you be my patient? And I'm like, therapy is for everybody else.
Yeah, 20 minutes later, you're sobbing hysterically on the floor.
Here's how he convinced me. He said, you go to the gym to work out your body. Let's work out your brain.
Right.
And I'm like, okay. And this is free?
Yeah. So then,
that was my introduction. But other than that, I would have kind of poo-pooed it. But now I'm such a big advocate, especially I see what they do at Dee Dee Hirsch. And I see that, like I said, when I drive by at midnight and I see those lights are on, that crisis hotline.
And what's so important, and I think is sort of the magic of the sign outside with Dee Dee Hirsch, is we're reaching out to a completely multicultural community. Because still in so many groups, therapy is considered shameful. And dealing with mental health is considered shameful. And people really do feel like suicide is the only way out. And to be able to run to talk to a spectrum of all the people that make up Los Angeles, awesome.
Should we put out a word if there are any signs to look for?
Well, I'm not a clinical.
Okay. We're going to be talking with Dee Dee Hirsch.
Right, you let Keita tell you all that.
Keita, yeah.
I don't want to say something wrong and be like, and I was crying because I don't like my shoes and my feet. Right. You know, I don't want to, you know, I'm joking, obviously, but I don't want to.
Right. I guess whenever I see somebody in crisis, I give them that hotline number.
If I see someone in big crisis, I will suggest a hotline number. Mm-hmm. If someone's in real crisis, obviously reach out and call yourself to get the person help. But I think it's more important that if you see someone starting to go into crisis, even if they're ignoring it, they need to start talking to someone. They need to go into therapy before it becomes time to call a hotline.
I'm trying to look up the number here real quick. Yes, I'm just going to put out that number.
Yes, yes.
800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. And it says here, if you know someone in crisis, call 800-273-8255. Even just to talk for a minute.
Or find out how to help the person. Yeah. I mean, that's what's so amazing at Dee Dee Hirsch is they're in all these schools teaching people. Mm-hmm. And so much of it is, again, just getting educated and not being afraid to get educated about it.
Well, you've been so gracious to share your story and your time. Is there a final message you want to leave us with?
Final message. God, I love a good sample sale.
You know what? I love that. Keep it light and bright.
Exactly.
Yes. Give us your Instagram and your Twitter.
I am Melissa Rivers Official on Instagram.
At Mel Rivers.
At Mel Rivers.
Very good.
There you go.
Well, I love it. You have all kinds of tidbits on fashion and flowers. And
thank
I just
you.
Love that.
Yeah, and by the way, you're working the print today.
Shopped in my closet.
Gotta shop the closet.
Shopped in my closet. Thank you so much. You're just a breath of fresh air. And I just love that you're an advocate. I love your voice. Thanks for coming to Olympic and Bundy and being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.